is the distinguished doctor from Cuba, and I'm sorry, in my excitement when I heard Dr. Keck announce you, I don't remember your name, but thank you very much for attending this session. And I just wanted to take a moment to thank FITS for supporting my research and just being a constant source of guidance and mentorship for me. And also to my colleague, Marcela Nunez-Smith, who has also become a lifelong friend thanks to this trip. Okay, we have nothing to disclose. We also want to be clear that our presentation does not represent the interests or views of Yale, ASTA, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, the George Washington University, Josiah Macy Foundation, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, which is the foundation that supported my research, doesn't appear on this slide, CT Health, NIH, NCI, NIMHD, Marisol Charters, or MEDIC. The first thing that we would like to do is explain to you exactly how we traveled to Cuba. We went on a U.S. Treasury's general license for professional research. We participated in a research program which was organized by Marisol Charters, Inc. MEDIC, which stands for the Medical Education in Cooperation with Cuba, did not sponsor the research delegation, but acted as consultants for Marisol on the content of this research program. I just want to show a really quick clip here of a speech that President Barack Obama gave in June of 2009 during the height of the health reform deliberations. And in it, you can hear his call for rethinking the cost of medical education and for rewarding students who practice in primary care or in underserved communities.
We need to rethink the cost of medical education.
Okay. I hope you all could hear that.
We need to rethink the problem.
Not advancing. There we go. Okay. So here's a snapshot of Cuba. I'm just going to give you some quick facts about the country. There are about 11 million inhabitants of Cuba, which makes it the most populous island nation in the Caribbean, as well as the largest by area. It's about 68,000 square miles. To the north of Cuba is the United States. To the west are the Bahamas and Mexico. And to the south are the Cayman Islands and Jamaica. And to the southeast are Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Median age of Cubans living on the island is about 38 and a half years old. Some of the main exports include sugar, nickel, tobacco, fish, medical products, citrus, and coffee. And I just have to say that one of the lasting impressions for me from this trip was the smell of smoke, of tobacco smoke, everywhere we went, hotels, just driving around in the streets, restaurants, anywhere you went, you could smell it. It was really quite extraordinary. We spent the majority of our time on this trip in Havana and with a few site visits to semi-rural areas that surrounded the capital. So as I've stated, this trip was a U.S. research delegation of clinicians, researchers, advocates, health system administrators, and others in the healthcare field, and it was to observe Cuba's system of medical education and the healthcare delivery system. One of the most extraordinary aspects of their healthcare system is that it is free, universal, accessible, and it achieves some impressive health outcomes. They have a saying there, we live like poor people, we die like rich people. Their health indicators rival those of the United States and other industrialized nations. Their life expectancy is roughly 77 years of age, which is very, very close to what ours is. They maintain one physician for every 168 people in the country, and they produce 2,000 new physicians each year. The infant mortality rate in Cuba is lower than in most cities in our country. And according to the United Nations Population Division, they rank just above the U.S. and 33rd overall in the world. The Cuban Ministry of Public Health maintains what's called a consultorio, which is a neighborhood clinic. It has a family doctor and a family nurse in residence with 24-hour call, and this serves 120 Cuban families, each of these clinics, in rural and urban areas. We just want to take a moment here to acknowledge that any photographs that you see were used with permission. We asked before we took any pictures if it was okay to do so, and we received permission. So again, Cuban healthcare delivery system, community-oriented primary care. It's a network, and it is accessible to all. They have a tiered design to their healthcare delivery system. As I mentioned, the first step is the consultorio. It's in every neighborhood, and it's for about 120 Cuban families. The family physician is paired with the nurse, and they serve the population defined by a geographic area that surrounds that particular clinic. Health promotion, disease prevention are emphasized at this level. And public health concepts really are integrated within clinical practice across the spectrum of the healthcare delivery service system. Patients requiring care beyond the scope of this family practice are then referred to what's known as a policlínico. This policlinic consists of interdisciplinary teams. They offer specialty care in a variety of areas, usually including pediatrics, internal medicine, nursing, social work, dentistry, physical therapy, and sometimes even cardiology, pulmonology, ophthalmology, neurology, endocrinology, dermatology, and psychiatry. Another very interesting point of note is that what we call complementary and alternative medicine here is designated as natural and traditional medicine in Cuba, and it is integrated in the polyclinic as a separate sort of specialty, if you will. That's also becoming increasingly available throughout the country. There are 440 polyclinics. Each polyclinic serves 30 to 40 of those consultorios, which are the family medicine clinics. For me, again, one of the most striking images from this trip was when we were at the polyclinic and we went to the urgent care area. Every seat was empty. Nobody was waiting for urgent care. And I think that tells the story itself. Should further specialized care be needed beyond the polyclinic, they then are referred out to a hospital. So Cuba has an explicit mission to train physicians for under-communities of the world. Similar to what Fitz spoke about earlier, but the work we've done, they have a social mission to confront the needs of not only the most vulnerable, but to confront the needs of all people in their country. They believe that health is a social responsibility of the government, and more importantly, that it is an individual right of every citizen of that country. Given their extraordinary health indicators and the notion of healthcare as a right, Cuba's model of health equity can be used as a tool to combat health disparities around the world. Two quick quotes that I took away from our trip. One was from the director of a polyclinic that we visited in a semi-rural area, and she said, and forgive me for my Spanish, she said, no es fácil, pero no hay problema. And what that means is it's not easy, but it's not a problem. And that is how they run and provide their health care in that country. The second came from a mental health clinic director, and she said, sin tratar y tratar a los demás como seres humanos. And the basic translation of that is that it is just a general belief to be treated and to treat others as human beings. Okay, where are we here? Thank you. I think we're on to the next. Perfect. So quick history here of this of ELAM, Cuba's Latin American School of Medicine. In 1999, in response to the devastating hurricanes George and Mitch, Cuba established this medical school known as ELAM Latin American School of Medicine. It was established specifically to train non-Cuban doctors so that they could return to their countries of origin and provide care to their communities. It is operated by the Cuban government and may be the largest medical school in the world by enrollment, with about 10,000 students from 29 countries, as reported, enrolled in 2006, early 2007. All of those enrolled are international students from outside Cuba. Most are from Latin America, Caribbean, and Africa, as well as the United States. Their goal is to improve healthcare infrastructure in poor communities lacking healthcare, and the training curriculum is oriented towards primary care, public health, hands-on clinical experience. Next. Thank you. So in June 2000, a delegation from the U.S. Congressional Black Caucus was invited to visit the Latin American School of Medicine and to meet with Fidel Castro. Representative Benny Thompson from Mississippi recounted to Castro the great need for medical doctors throughout the impoverished Mississippi Delta. And the extraordinary thing that happened on the spot in that moment was that Castro offered full scholarships to U.S. citizens to go to the Latin American School of Medicine and obtain their medical degree free of charge on full scholarship. They are provided a room and board. So it originally was for those in Benny Thompson's district, and then Castro expanded it to all students from areas that are represented by the Congressional Black Caucus. And in a September 2000 speech at the Riverside Church in New York City, Castro announced a further expansion to provide several hundred slots at ELAM for students from medical underserved communities anywhere in the United States. So now you're going to see a clip from a movie called Salud, the film. Salud translated means health. This is a 2007 feature documentary, and it explores the Cuban healthcare system and the Cuban-trained health professionals who provide medical care across the world. And if you listen carefully, I know it's a bit quiet. You might recognize a voice in the room, sitting in the front row. Where did it come out? Here? Okay.
Hello. Good afternoon, everyone. So for the couple more minutes that we're going to formally present, I wanted to focus some on the experience of U.S. citizens who are studying at Elam. And I have to just take a second to say that traveling to Cuba was really transformative for me professionally. It was an amazing opportunity and one that I cherish a lot for many reasons, including meeting my dear colleague here, Gretchen, and strengthening that relationship. But a highlight of the trip was interacting with those students at Elam. Just a little, thank you, just a little bit on the students before they get before they come to Cuba. So as we discussed before, the objective, as arranged with the Congressional Black Caucus, was to recruit students from minority, racial, ethnic minority communities, and low-income backgrounds here. One of the things that you find when you talk to students at Elam who are U.S. citizens is that they really found the cost of a U.S. medical education prohibitive. Even the application fees for many people represented a true barrier to entering the medical profession. As far as some of the requirements, students need to have completed at least 2 years of pre-med college courses, and no MCAT is required. Just bring it all up. So in addition to being U.S. citizens, you need to be between age 18 to 30, physically and mentally fit, again, coming from the neediest communities, having some pre-med science background, and really have this commitment to practicing medicine in underserved U.S. communities. So this is why people are going. Really, they do have a social mission to return. IFCO, also known as Pastors for Peace, is the sort of first step for interested applicants who submit transcripts as well as have in-person interviews with members of IFCO and submit letters of recommendation. The decision is then ultimately made among all of these parties, including administrators at Elam and members of the Cuban Ministry of Public Health. So interestingly enough, the education, of course, is conducted in Spanish language, and not all of the applicants are Spanish language proficient. So if you think about a commitment to becoming a physician, many people have to acquire additional language skills before they're able to actually participate in the curriculum at Elam. So Elam, of course, is prepared for this and does offer a 12-week intensive course in Spanish language before beginning the program. And we'll just bring them all up. So some differences, perhaps, and we'll tease these out, probably many more similarities to our medical education system here in the U.S. But at Elam, the standard course of study is 6 years. The last year is really more of an internship or a prelim year for those who are familiar. The classes are taught in Spanish. Similarly to the system we have here, years one and two are taught at Elam in combined classrooms, right, with all of the students from all over the world. Years three to six are clerkships or are based at any of the 21 teaching hospitals that are in Cuba. And the ultimate goal, of course, is for U.S. students to be able to take the U.S. MLE STEP exams so that they can return to the United States to complete residency training and enter the workforce here. We won't go through the list, but obviously year one and year two, very heavy theoretical study base, parallel to what we do here, and similar clinical rotations across years three to six, with the students gaining autonomy progressively over the course of those final years of training. The Elam curriculum is accredited by the WHO as well as the ECFMG. And just a moment, I mean, we'll go quickly through this, but it's very much a challenge, thank you, for any international medical graduate to match in a residency program in the United States. And we just have some numbers from 2011. Well, you'll see that close to 11,000 international medical graduates did apply to the match program. And of those, 44% matched successfully. If you break those down, U.S. IMGs, so people who are U.S. citizens but have gone abroad to train, and anyone graduating from Elam would be in that category of a U.S. IMG. They have a slight advantage in the match process, matching at about a 50% rate compared with non-U.S. citizen international medical graduates who matched at about 41%. Thank you. Of course, for U.S. medical graduates, they tend to be very successful in the match at 94% match rate. So when you look at the numbers for students and graduates of Alam, you'll see that there is actually a very substantial cohort in study in Cuba. We're looking at 164 roughly enrolled in classes for the sort of next 10 years out, with 66 graduates for the classes of 07 to 2011. And to our knowledge, there are 9 graduates who are in residency in the U.S. or have been in residency in the U.S. So, you know, I apologize because we've sort of sped through a little bit for time, but if people can stay, really the idea for us was to try to engage the group in a conversation. Certainly, as someone thinking about medical education, I'm very much focused on the med school pipeline and thinking about how we bring both diversity of many dimensions, including racial, ethnic, into our physician workforce, but also how we think about our needs in a primary care workforce. So given what Gretchen told you earlier, these students are extraordinarily prepared in delivering primary care to populations, and particularly in low-resource settings. And the majority of them are self-identified as racial ethnic minorities and also from SES disadvantaged backgrounds. And so as we've talked and reflected on our trip, is it helpful for us to think as a community really in this room about some of the challenges and potential benefits of thinking more about this opportunity for students interested in pursuing medical careers, but also for those 160-plus students who have already committed to getting their education at Alam. So I do apologize for sort of that rush there at the end, but we'll stop, and thank you all again for coming, of course, and we'll stick behind for questions if others have to leave for sessions. Thank you.
Thank you all for attending. We have, if folks want to stay for a couple of minutes and ask questions, that's fine. I think the next group starts at 2:30. So if you do have questions, you can ask a few, and those who can stay. So.
Mm-hmm. Hey, so can you talk a little bit about the
Do you want me to start?
Yeah.
So, you know, we did have this opportunity. The trip was very well hosted, and we had an opportunity to spend a lot of time in clinical settings. We went rounds several times. And so, as you could imagine, I mean, we didn't... When I attend, you know, we have these radiology rounds, which is this big deal. We go off, we look at all the fancy MRIs and CTs for half the day, more time than we spend at the patient bedside, we spend with the radiologist. And this was quite the reverse on our trip. So certainly, for the wards where we rounded, they were using, you know, x-rays and clinical acumen. And I think that there is some, this is not to gloss over what is a challenge. Obviously, the medical care is delivered differently there than it is here. But I was impressed by the clinical acumen and skill, which is really what you then have to know your physical exam very well when you don't have MRIs and CAT scans and ultrasound machines. And so that is a plus, I think, potentially.
We can take questions, a couple more questions for the entire panel. We still have a few panelists here. So any additional questions for either Dr. Mullen or Ms. O, I forget your name, but that group as well.
No,
we'll clarify.
Yeah, we will clarify. The trip was sponsored by Montessol Charters, which is a company that is licensed to book travel to Cuba for U.S. citizens. The research program was prepared in consultation with Medic. We did not contribute to the research program itself. It was predetermined and set, and so we had a full agenda of research activities, site visits, and so forth that took place over the course of the week.
Right. I think it'd be very accurate to say that it was really a knowledge exchange, and we spent a lot of time with public health colleagues there and others really in dialogue, and out of that potentially might spring research pairings and partnerships. But, right, I think exactly.
Okay, we can do one more question, and I'm sorry, that's Ms. Overson, group. Okay, go ahead.
Well,
Well, my name is Charlene King, and I'm a psych mental health nurse practitioner from Mississippi, actually from the area where
resident.
And initially when Dr. Mullen presented, it sounded like there was a little apprehension there about the nurses and BNPs stepping in, providing some of the services that physicians have been providing. But because I'm from the rural South Central Mississippi, in that area we only have one primary care physician, and I'm the only nurse practitioner in the area, not even a family nurse practitioner. Some rotate, come to that area, you know, to provide services. But of course, we there's no accessibility, you know, help. And so, what are Dr. Mullen, your thoughts of DNP or advanced practice nurses having to step in and provide those services where we don't have physicians to offer it to the population of people?
I'm a huge fan of nurse practitioners, PAs, and I'm ambivalent about the doctor nursing practice, not from a clinical point of view, but because the NP has been so successful in this decision on the part of nursing leadership to essentially supplant the NP with the DNP, with the implications for longer training, more expensive training, and then expectations, presumably, of better remuneration out the other side. I think as a workforce researcher and a workforce policy person, it's a little worrisome. If it works, it'll be good, but I can see it going off the tracks in a lot of ways. And it certainly will attract fire from physicians, not for me in a clinical sense. So I think it's an experiment that's been driven by both needs and also a nursing agenda, which is okay when every profession has agendas. But the fact that we have now have people doing things that they would have been arrested for 50 years ago as nurse practitioners and as BNPs is quite an extraordinary change that most people in the population don't appreciate. And I actually think the BNP is building a doctor by another route. Most people in nursing would say, no, no, the doctor nursing practice will be different. I don't think so. Essentially, clinically, they will be doing, depending upon the person and the capabilities, the same thing physicians do. So my quip about once upon a time was only medical schools would produce a doctor. Now I think some nursing schools are producing a doctor, even though everybody's squeamish about what they call it and how it works. And I do think the DNP is messing with something that's worked very well and with a somewhat uncertain outcome in terms of how it plays out, people doing it in the system as a whole. That's everything I think.
Yeah, I think we can take one more question.
I just have a quick announcement. Thank you all for this informative discussion. My name is Henrietta Salazar. I'm actually the communications director at MEDIC, Medical Education Cooperation with Cuba. So if you're interested, we do have some upcoming research programs that I'd be happy to talk to you more about, as well as at our booth, 5108, we have also online the latest issue of the MEDIC Review, which is our publication, our International Journal of Health on Human Health and Medicine. Dr. Fidel Nunez is our guest editor of this latest issue, and our editor-in-chief is right here. So please stop by our booth, 5108. We'd be happy to tell you more about the research programs and other program work that we do to support U.S. students in Cuba at the medical school.
Thank you for coming. You all continue to ask questions, but we can't do it formally anymore. So thank you all for coming.